This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
Welcome back to Heard Tell. I'm Andrew Donaldson. Thank you so much for giving us the most precious thing you have, your time, as we continue to do what we always try to do. Turn down the noise of the news cycle. Get to the information that we actually need to properly discern the times we live in. We're going to take a little time to talk about the election. No, not ours, not the hot mess in U.S. politics where it's Biden versus Trump, part deux, and people don't really seem to want it. But their actions say we're going to get it. We're going to take a break and go over to the UK. Now, they just had some elections. Now, this isn't the big general election that everybody's been kind of waiting on to be called. No, these are the by-elections, local elections. We're going to talk about some of the terminology. We're going to talk about what they do and don't mean when you apply it widely. And we're going to talk a little bit about why we talk about UK and elections in the first place and why we cover stuff in other countries. Well, because of a couple of reasons. One is, it's good to have outside perspective on what's going on in the world. The UK is a very important ally to America and the larger world. We also need to understand that things like politics, there's differences, especially in a parliamentary system as opposed to a representative democracy like we have in America. And we're going to get into all those. But human nature doesn't really change. Human politics is about human nature when you really get down to it. So there's things going on in the UK that do have applications. Things like changing cultural times, things like what do you do with industrial areas that aren't industrial anymore as we go more to a service-based and tech-based economies? What do you do about things like immigration? How a really big election win can actually be a problem for a political party? And how does things like world events affect that? Harrison Griffiths is the perfect person to talk about this. He's covered politics and done things and been a commentator in the UK for a while. He has a day job at a place over there. So he actually doesn't just do politics full time, but he's also pretty well versed on American politics. In fact, he wrote his thesis in school on Southern realignment and politics in America. He can talk about it. He actually references America. He threw in some West Virginia references just because he knew he's going to be talking to me and he's really smart like that. He can talk about both and he can give us some things that we should be paying attention to over there, give us some examples here that aren't perfect examples, but let us understand what's going on. Harrison's just really, really good at this stuff. And because he doesn't do it all the time, it also gives him good proper perspective. And he's very self-aware and says, like, look, I'm a little bit more in the Westminster bubble, so I see it this way. This is what I think. This is what I know. He differentiates. He talks about how people he has policy disagreements with but can still give you good points about him. He can talk about how the wider electorate doesn't agree with him on some things he wish they did, how he doesn't agree with them on some things. He has great insight, really sharp guy, knows both sides of the pond, and is the perfect person to talk about this. And we talked longer than I really intended to because it was just so much good stuff. Not just who's winning and losing elections, but stuff underneath it. Things like how Brexit became a big point of realignment in UK politics. Things like how immigration and radicalism and things like this are starting to creep in. We talk about, of course, Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer, the current prime minister and the soon-to-be prime minister whenever they get around to having an election. We talk about the ins and the outs of the by-elections, what it all means. It is so important to have a global understanding, even while we try to keep local perspective on things. This is just something that really helps in understanding when the news cycle is just screaming headlines at you all the time. The wider your perspective can be and the wider your base of knowledge is, keeps you from getting tunnel visioned on stuff a lot. So while there's a lot of sameness in our headlines all the time, it's good to take a step back once in a while. It doesn't mean you're disengaging. See what's going on in other parts of the world, kind of recenter yourself, take some lessons from that, and then come back and look at the hot mess we have going on home and domestically, and you get a little bit of a clear head and a clear perspective on it. Plus, let's admit it, this election is a hot mess. It's kind of nice to spend a little time talking about some other people's problems, right? And we joke about that a little bit with Harrison Griffiths. So, UK elections, the by-elections, what it means, what's going on over in the UK, really fascinating stuff. Harrison Griffiths, great guest, real good, heavy conversation, grown folk talk about politics. I think you'll get a lot out of it. I know I did. I learned some things. We'll get to it right after this.
What if I told you that you can support your blood pressure and healthy CoQ10 levels with two chews a day? The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. That's like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 supports your cardiovascular health. Visit RadioBeats.com and find out how you can get a free 30-day supply on bundles and save 15% with the promo code DEAL.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome back to Herd Tell. Okay, don't know if you heard tell or not, but they've been doing some voting over in the UK, and it's not just the voting they're doing. It's bringing up a lot of other things, past, present, and future. So let's go over to the UK. One of our friends from over there, he's been on here before. It's just been a while. He's a classical liberal commentator over in the UK for a think tank in that great land across the sea. My friend Harrison Griffin's back with us. How are you, sir? Great to see you again.
I'm very well. Thanks for having me on, Andrew.
Let's start big picture for a second, because I want to get the nomenclature right. America, we would probably call these local elections or municipality elections. It's a little different in the parliamentary UK system, but just give us, we're going to talk about these elections and we'll talk about the big players, Rishi Sunak, Keir Starmer, all that in a second. Give us the nomenclature for what these are, though, because it's a different system. So you have councils, you have mayors, a little different thing than when we think of a mayor of like New York City or somewhere, or even your local mayor. These council elections really matter. These mayoral elections really matter because they're the feeder system into the MP system. Just give people the nomenclature and the background on what a by and a local election means in the UK.
Yeah, so actually, there's been a bit of a tendency over the last few years to start referring to these as midterm elections, a bit of an Americanism imported into the UK. And technically speaking, they are midterm elections, even though we're getting close to the end of the term now. But they are very different to yours insofar as they matter less in terms of the tangible political landscape. So in your midterms, you'll have elections for the for a third of the Senate, for the whole House of Representatives, for an awful lot of seats in state government, for I think 36 governorships in your midterms. These don't matter anything like as much as that. These are elections for local councils, which are basically, in the modern day, the people who fill potholes in the roads and manage the collection of people's waste bins. They don't have as much power as even they used to. They don't have as much power as some people perhaps would like. But, you know, they matter to some extent. They matter to the day-to-day delivery of certain government services. For the most part, the big things they do, like, for example, delivering adult social care, are mandates that are set for them by the central government and funded by the central government. They're basically elected bureaucrats. They're elected executives in that way. So they don't matter quite as much, but they do matter for the general political environment. They're a good vibe test, so to speak. And we don't quite have the same sort of political trend that you guys usually have in your midterms, whereby whoever's the incumbent usually gets beaten, and in recent years gets beaten quite bad in midterm elections, save of course for the last set in 2022. Ours are a bit more mixed. Usually the governing party will take a bit of a hit, but it's not usually a massive hit. And sometimes in recent years, including 3 years ago, the governing party did very well. Boris Johnson's Conservative Party were in the middle of their vaccine bounce after the COVID pandemic and won quite a lot of seats in 2021. This time round, they lost quite a lot. And that was just in the local elections, where, you know, they lost about half of their local council seats. There were also elections for regional mayors in 12 regions in England. The Conservatives lost 11 out of 12, including losing their very popular, really incumbent mayor in the West Midlands, Andy Street. They lost a traditional Conservative heartland in North Yorkshire as well. These were not good elections for the Conservatives. And more worrying, I think, the most worrying kind of exhibition of how unpopular they are at the moment was the by-election in Blackpool South, where the Conservative MP has gone, resigned, and the Labour MP cleaned up that seat. It's a traditional Labour seat. But the Conservatives won it in 2019 in their big Boris Johnson-inspired landslide, and they've lost it very comfortably this time.
You've set it up perfectly. It seems like we've been talking about this for almost 2 years, really. The Conservative Party, the Tories, have an inertia problem. They've just been in power for so long. Eventually, you know, trees don't grow to the sky. Eventually, people get tired of a party. There was some things that artificially extended what their time cycle probably would be. There was the Brexit. There was the Boris Johnson stuff, things like that. But it feels like we've been talking about this impending demise of the Tories for probably 2 years now, on and off. They've had an inertia problem. Now, on top of the inertia problem, just optically looking at it, they also got a bit of a chaos problem. They went through the scandals with Boris, the Liz Truss mess. Rishi Sunak hasn't really been able to get his feet under him in any measurable way. Those are the two overriding things, even more than policies and politics and those things. Those seem to be the two driving things right now. And they've been things that have been going for a while. Like, I remember doing shows 2 years ago where we're talking about, well, when are they going to call election? Because this is bad. And here we are.
Yeah, he'll probably hang on now until the last minute. There were some plans, it seems, for a summer general election. Reports since the drubbing in the local elections have suggested that they're now very much shelved. But he probably will hang on till January because, well, you know, stay in for as long as you can when you're staring down the barrel of a massive defeat. And also, they probably have a marginally better chance of saving their bacon in January because it's more likely then you'd be looking at interest rates going down, for example, which is something out of their control. Well, when we look in British political history at people like Tony Blair and Margaret Thatcher, you know, these two people won three elections on the spin. and they are kind of extraordinary in British political history. Now, you might look at the Conservative Party now and say, well, you've won four elections in a row. They won the largest number of seats in 2010 and 2017. They won majorities in 2015 and 2019. So you might say, hey, this was a pretty good run for you guys. But I don't think it's quite right to understand this in a similar way to Blair or Thatcher, because really, three very different types of Conservative Party have won these elections. David Cameron in 2010 and 2015 was very much a modernising, centrist, moderate Conservative. Theresa May comes in off the back of Brexit. She very much more what I call a communitarian type Conservative. It's a similar type of politics that you guys, that's quite popular in West Virginia, for example, the left on economics, right on culture, coming in trying to get Brexit done. She obviously failed quite miserably at that. And then Boris Johnson comes in, really kind of doubling down on the Brexit stuff. He had an increasingly unpopular far left Jeremy Corbyn as his opponent. And you know, these are all very different types of Conservative Party, really. You could, in a slightly different political landscape, have these three people representing both sides of the political divide. And so it's not quite the same. And now you're really looking at the end of the road. Rishi Sunak doesn't really have much that defines him politically in the way that Boris, Cameron and even Theresa May did. And yeah, he inherited a bit of a mess, which was not necessarily his doing. Even the mess created by Liz Truss was not entirely her own fault. We're in an era of post-COVID inflation, higher interest rates. The Liz Truss debacle revealed how unsound some of the foundations of the British economy actually are. Most of that isn't Rishi Sunak's fault. But it's also fair to say on the other side that he hasn't really grasped the mantle, and that he's kind of continued this Conservative trajectory of alienating everybody. Their rhetoric appeals to the political right, but they haven't delivered much on their rhetoric, so the right doesn't like them. And at the same time, their rhetoric is off-putting for moderates and perhaps people on the centre-left who might have considered voting Conservative before. So they really have stood in the middle of the road and got hit by both sides of the traffic. And now I think we're really seeing that come to fruition to some extent.
Yeah, Harrison Griffiths joining us from over in the UK. It's interesting in the, you know, the postmortems, we call them over here after the elections, the Monday shouting, as it were. The one thing everybody seems to agree on, Sky, BBC, The Times, they're all using the same number. They peg Labour having about a 9-point lead nationally right now after this. Everybody seems to agree on that number. You just touched on it, though. Everything that could go Labour's way is going Labour's way right now. There's no excitement for Rishi Sunak. There's the inertia we just talked about. There's all these other factors. Is this a glass half full or a glass half empty number? Because it's, 9 points, that's a pretty healthy lead. You could probably get a majority in Parliament with that. Maybe not a huge majority, but a functional one. But then on the other hand, you kind of step back and go, wait, they're only up 9 points, even though absolutely everything's going their way. Which one of those is true, or are they both true?
So if there were a general election today and the Labour Party won it by 9 points, that would be an incredibly disappointing result, I think. They would still be forming a government, but they would be kind of on the precipice of a majority government. It would be a small majority or even a very close to majority. They might have to rely on support from the Scottish Nationalists and or the Liberal Democrats to form a government there. That's probably not an accurate picture going into a general election. So that 9-point margin you referenced is... It's an attempt to project the national vote off the basis of the popular vote results in the local elections, and that's not really a particularly useful way to project the notional national vote. Really, it's not particularly an accurate picture. So the opinion polls are there is a spread of the opinion polls. But they have Labour up somewhere between 15 and 25 points, much higher than that 9-point level. And in reality, it probably is. So that national vote projection, which has them with a 9-point lead, has the Liberal Democrats on 17%. That's not going to happen. And it also has other parties, so like local parties, independents, also parties like the Greens, Reform Party, on a combined 25%. And that's highly unlikely to happen as well. So you should definitely take that projection with a pinch of salt. Labour are almost certainly much further in the lead, and that probably overstates the Liberal Democrats and others as well. This is going to be much worse for the Conservatives than a 9-point loss. in all likelihood, I think. And then you've got kind of on the other side of it, you say, well, everything that could be going Labour's way is going Labour's way. For the most part, that's true. But this set of local elections has revealed something that's somewhat concerning to Keir Starmer, and really somewhat concerning to everybody in the UK, is that outside of Northern Ireland, we very rarely have sectarian voting. You very rarely have people voting on the basis of their ethnic identity, of their religious identity, except in Northern Ireland, where that very much is a mainstay, and perhaps in some parts of Glasgow and Scotland as well. But what we've seen is areas, wards, where there are very high percentage of Muslim voters, we have seen big swings against the Labour Party in favour of local independents or independent candidates sponsored by George Galloway's far-left anti-Israel party, the Workers' Party of Great Britain. And that should concern Keir Starmer, because Muslim voters traditionally are overwhelmingly pro-Labour. And we're seeing a rebellion against them over their position on Gaza and Israel at the moment. And look, Muslims, I think, are about 6 or 7% of total registered voters. They're not going to stop Keir Starmer winning. They're not going to stop him winning a landslide. But it's a concerning trend beginning to develop that a war hundreds of miles away is influencing votes in the United Kingdom. On the island of Great Britain, at the very least, as I say, Northern Ireland's a bit of an exception. But in Great Britain, we've not seen sectarian voting like this for many hundreds of years. And that's a concerning trend. And that's something that it won't keep Keir Starmer awake at night, but, you know, it might cost him an hour or two of sleep.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Yeah, Harrison Griffin's joining us. You just brought it up. What of these other parties, the Lib Dems and the Greens, are they protest votes or are they actually going to gain ground? We know Galloway, and folks, if you don't know anything about him, there's plenty to read that is not good reading. This is not a good individual. You can read it up on your own time. Are these protest votes swelling them up? Are they actually gaining ground? Is it just because, even if we're going to use that 9% number as a lead, that's a 34-25 split. Those are small number. Are they actually gaining any ground, or are these just protest votes with the Lib Dems and the Greens and everybody else?
So I think we've got to put everybody in different buckets for this. So the Lib Dems traditionally always do much better in local elections than they do in general elections. And so we highlighted some of the differences between US midterms and UK midterms, so to speak. One of the big differences is that, generally speaking, in the UK, we don't have quite as much split ticket voting as you have done in the US. It's kind of dying a bit in the US now. But again, to use West Virginia as an example, right? Between the year 2000, where George W. Bush wins West Virginia at presidential level, and 2016, where Trump is Trump's strongest state, between that time, the Democratic Party is still the dominant force in the state of West Virginia, for the most part, right? Until kind of the early 2010s, you don't even see small chinks in the Democratic Party's armor. That's split ticket voting, right? I'll vote for the Republican for president, and I'll vote for Democrats in state and local elections. West Virginia is the archetypal example of that going back a little while. In the UK, we have that less, but the Lib Dems are an example of where we see the trend ever so slightly. So in places like Watford, which is just north of London, in places like Hull in the northeast of England and Yorkshire, the Lib Dems pretty much dominate locally, but don't really register in parliamentary elections. So the Lib Dems are one of the parties that tends to do better, generally speaking, locally anyway. But of course, they are also genuinely on the up. So if they're, you know, if we're taking projections of a general election tomorrow, for example, the Lib Dems will be on to gain quite a number of seats. They could end up, depending on how far the Conservative Party vote drops, they could end up somewhere between kind of 30 and 60 seats. If we're talking about a general election, the Liberal Democrats are targeting seats in what we call what has started to be called the Blue Wall, which is Conservative seats in southern England, which are filled with middle-class homeowners who overwhelmingly voted to remain in the EU. They would have loved David Cameron back in the day. They voted to remain in the EU and they've been turned off by the Conservative Party's wranglings over Brexit. And also the Liberal Democrats, unfortunately, have become the party of NIMBYism, opposition to house building. And that's also a bit of a vote winner for them in the south of England. So the Liberal Democrats are genuinely on the up, but they always do better in local elections. So we can't take too much out of this result. As I say, the Lib Dems are not going to get 17% at the general election. The Greens as well, they're not going to do as well as the Lib Dems, but they are also on the up. And again, in the last few cycles, have traditionally done well at local elections. They have benefited in the north from some of this protest vote against Labour for their position on Gaza and Israel. The Greens are a very Israel-sceptic political party. And then, again, independents. We, as you would imagine, it's also the case to some extent in the US as well. The further you go down the scale, the more the independents are likely to do well. You've got a smaller number of voters. If you're organising an independent campaign for president, that's an extremely difficult thing to do, because how do you establish yourself? How do you connect to voters? If you're running an independent, you know, campaign for sheriff in a county in the US, it's much easier to, like, you know, you might already be well known in the local area. You can talk to people much easier. So you have more independence at the local level. And then there is this rise in candidates backed by the Galloway group on the far left, who have genuinely done well as a protest vote. Now, what does this all mean for the general election? The Lib Dems will do well, probably, but not as well as these elections suggest. The Greens will probably see an increase in their vote share off the back of an anti-Labour protest, but the first-past-the-post system means it's very unlikely that the Greens will take any more seats than the one that they have at the moment that they've had since 2010. But as for the kind of the anti-Labour far-left protest vote, which will be divided between the Greens and George Galloway's Workers' Party, we just don't know. We don't know how strong that is at the moment, and we don't know what that's going to look like come the election. But again, it's something that might keep Keir Starmer awake a little bit, because everything else really is going very well for him.
Is Keir Starmer's problems, and again, he's probably going to be the next prime minister, so we're talking problems of degrees here. You know, he's not going to fall off a cliff or something like that politically, as far as we know. Keir Starmer's problem, is it political and policy, or is it the country wants a change moment, but they don't really see a change leader? And with all due respect, Keir Starmer, who's not the most charismatic guy and not really offering a whole lot of groundbreaking stuff, is part of the issue here just a little bit of, okay, we want change, but Keir Starmer isn't exactly a super inspiring guy. He's just kind of the next guy in line. Again, all due respect to somebody that's knighted. That kind of feels like a image problem or a vibe problem, as you called it earlier. That's not really a fixable thing, is it? Is that part of what's gumming up the works here?
Yeah. So to put it in perspective, I think, like, the British people are really sick of politics. We're going to see a comparatively low turnout election, I think, in whenever it is in late 2024, early 2025. And that's reflected in Keir Starmer. So you're right, Keir Starmer is going to be the next prime minister, unless something dramatic happens in the meantime. And it will be quite a comfortable win. But he is the most popular frontline politician in the country. But to put that in perspective, he is less popular than John Major was on the eve of John Major getting battered by Tony Blair in a landslide election in 1997. So politicians writ large are not very popular in this country at the moment. Keir Starmer, you couldn't say that Keir Starmer is responsible for, like, motivating an awful lot of voters to go and vote Labour. But you don't really need that in Britain. It's the same in America. You know, people who have argued that, you know, Bernie Sanders will be a strong candidate because he'll motivate lots of progressive non-voters to come and vote for the Democrats. He'll excite them. But the numbers really aren't just there. Politics is still, in the UK and the US, one in the middle. And Keir Starmer's basically come out and said, look, there's a very clear difference between me and my predecessor, far left Jeremy Corbyn, extremely unpopular, extremely radical, and got battered in 2019 by Boris Johnson. I'm more moderate policy-wise. I'm more moderate in you know, kind of vibe-wise. I'm a safe pair of hands. You know, when I look at Keir Starmer, I personally disagree with an awful lot of his philosophy, his economics, his politics, whatever. But when I look at him, I say, hey, I trust you with the nuclear weapons. Like, that's a good thing. I certainly would not have trusted Jeremy Corbyn with the nuclear weapons, right? And so he's a knight of the realm, as you say. He was director of public prosecutions. He's an esteemed lawyer. He's a safe pair of hands. And particularly when you have such kind of, people are so sick of the Conservative Party at the moment, you can see how that translates into an easy win for him. He's a safe pair of hands. He's not motivating many people, but who cares? Because usually guys that motivate people to come out and bat are the guys who alienate the centre. Keir Starmer's not doing that. He may not be the inspiring candidate. He may not be particularly exciting, but he has staked out the centre ground. And in a time where the Conservative Party is historically unpopular, a safe pair of hands and a bit of a centrist is all you need to win an election. He will win it handily. And again, while he may do a lot of things that I don't like, the country is not going to suffer any crisis because Prime Minister, if the country is faced with a crisis, there's no doubt in my mind that he would be very good at dealing with it. And I think that's the view of the whole country, even if they're not necessarily particularly excited by his policy prospectus.
Yeah, Harrison Griffith joining us. We're joking about, you're joking about, like, well, I trust him with the nuclear weapons. That's kind of the low standard of national governance. And then, like, oh, well, he's not going to get us nuked and he's not going to do anything incredibly stupid in the world. But you're joking about it. But everybody I talk to in the UK, our UK friends, I consume quite a bit of media. That's almost the prevalent view across the parties right now. People are you called it sick of politics. It's actually more than that, isn't it? It's not just sick of politics. It's sick of whatever the post-Brexit kind of political malaise, to use the old Carter term in the US. That's kind of what it feels like. It's just like, okay, nothing's really changing here. We're just kind of in this middle spot and nobody knows how to really get out of it. That just seems to be an overwhelming feeling amongst the people in the UK, young, old, doesn't matter which party you talk to. Where's that coming from, do you think? Is it economic? Is it change? What do you think's causing? Because there's got to be a core to that beyond just electoral politics, right?
That's a very tough question. And I think there are a lot of potential answers to it. So,
but that's the issue, yeah? Like, that's really...
Yeah, it seems to me. And look, you know, always take it with a pinch of salt insofar as I work in the Westminster bubble. My ideas and viewpoints on policy are not particularly popular in the UK. I regret to say, I wish they were maybe. But yeah, my sense is people are just really bored of this. And it's similar in the US. You just got an awful lot of people who perhaps have been left behind by the economic trajectory of the country. You know, Britain has become, and this in my view is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's become a more high-skilled economy. It's become a more city-centric economy. It's become a less industrialized, less manufacturing economy. This is true of countries across the West, including the US. And a lot of people get left behind by that. And when people do get left behind, and when you already have large existing government infrastructure, people's expectations of politics rise about what politicians can and should do to fix their problems. And again, I'll reference West Virginia, not just because you're there, but because I think it is a very good parallel to a lot of the key voters who have emerged in the UK as well. Is there's this realignment where you have a lot of working class people in traditional hard industry, steel, coal mining, will often be a member of the union and will voted for the centre-left party, right? That's West Virginia. Mostly working class people, coal miners, union men, love FDR, love JFK, Democrats. In the north of England, north and west Midlands, central belt of Scotland, same story. Coal miners, steel workers, union men, always voted Labour, love Harold Wilson, loved Clement Attlee, yeah, these labor giants. But at the same time, those industries have died, and the general culture that existed at the time when those parts of the world were ascendant has also died as well. And so you have these groups of people whose economic base has gone, who are rather socially conservative and pang for a time where, you know, things were different. I don't know, to really caricature it, I don't mean to reduce it to this, but to really caricature it, you know, when men were men, you know, when your community was very close-knit, tightly bonded, you know, everyone went to the pub on a Friday night, workers and their wives, and everybody was kind of together. That time's gone, and people were upset by that. And I can understand why people are upset by that, like, completely. I mean, I grew up in the West Midlands. You see this everywhere when you go to cities and towns. And because of those changes, and that's caused a bit of a realignment in politics. And it's not exactly the same, because you've got the religious right in America, which kind of makes things very different to the UK. But you can roughly map it on as to having these, you call them the Obama-Trump voters, 16.5 million people who voted for Obama in 2012, who voted for Trump in 2016, who won the election for Donald Trump, in places like West Virginia, in Ohio, in Pennsylvania, you know, Western North Carolina and Virginia. Those types of voters map on quite well to what we call the Red Wall in the UK, which is a collection of just under 100 seats in the north of England and the West Midlands, which have been Labour for, in some cases, over a century, but went for the Conservatives in 2019 because of what Brexit represented. These people are overwhelmingly pro-Brexit. They're sceptical about immigration, but at the same time, they want more government redistribution. And that's a really difficult thing for the kind of elite consensus to get its head around, because it's traditionally been, well, the left party wants more redistribution, but are socially quite progressive. And the right party is more sceptical of redistribution, but are more socially conservative. Now, in the US, the realignment's been helped by the magic personal power of Donald Trump, who's come in and with his mostly vibes and gone, yeah, I'm slightly different. I mean, he still likes a tax cut for the rich, but at the same time, he's more of the working man's guy somehow. And in the UK, Boris Johnson was that a bit, but the elite in the Conservative Party were always much more sceptical of Boris Johnson and wanted to kind of get rid of him a bit more than the elites in the Republican Party, who have totally capitulated to Donald Trump or left the party. And so we have this uncomfortable tension between the elites, who have more influence over day-to-day politics, who are generally trying to reorient things more in perhaps the free market direction on the Conservative side, or on the Conservative side more in the socially conservative direction. And then on the Labour side, where it's like, how left-wing do we want to be on economics? How much do we want to embrace, you know, progressive ideas on, say, trans stuff, on immigration? Everyone's kind of confused. And it's not clear that the ideological offerings of the party are in line with what voters want. And I'm not necessarily saying that's a bad thing, because I kind of disagree with the voters on this. Luckily enough, I'm not a politician, so I don't have to pretend to. But, you know, that tension exists. And so basically nobody's getting what they want at the moment. Nobody. And because nobody's getting what they want, there are lots of, you know, elections are a really bad way for people to communicate what they want out of politicians. It's just like, here's a pre-offering of candidates and parties, tick a box. It doesn't tell us much. So the signals are all over the place. The people are not happy, that's all we know, but nobody really knows exactly why, other than the general malaise that is the economy. Everyone knows the economy is bad, people aren't happy. Nobody knows really how to fix it, and nobody knows, you know, nobody can reconcile what the people want in terms of fixing it with what they're willing to do. So it's basically just a massive confusion that is stopping anything getting done in Westminster. And it means that, you know, the people are very unhappy with politics. And that was a very long-winded answer with lots and lots of different bits to unpack, but that's just the way it is at the moment. And nobody's really got a great way of figuring out how to fix it.
Yeah, but that was really good stuff, and why we got to talk about it to understand why there's things going on in the electorate. Harrison Griff is breaking this down. You just touched on it. You know, in American politics in my lifetime, which, you know, I'm I'll be 44 here in a couple of weeks. So 1980, I was born. So, you know, caught the tail end of Carter as a baby, but basically Reagan, both Bushes, Clinton, Obama, Trump, those have been the presidents of my lifetime. The shift you talked about, look, when I went to register to vote in 1998 in the state of West Virginia, they didn't even ask you which party you were going to vote for. They just, you're Democrat. Yeah. If you asked for a Republican ballot, they probably wouldn't have known how to do it. Like, seriously, it was that's changed in 25 years, massive swing. The thing that represents that swing in America was really the election of Donald Trump. It brought a lot of, there was a lot before that. There was things that built up to it, but that was the moment where people realized there's a massive shift. You just mentioned it. In the UK, and it's really funny because Labour is openly talking about this, that they're going to go out and get back these voters that they lost in 2016 and 2019 and then the post-Brexit stuff. And the Conservatives are talking about it. Hey, we're starting to lose these voters. It was Brexit. That's what really is the splitting point in at least the last 10, 15 years in UK politics. The Conservatives, I think, are starting to wonder, hey, this big majority we got after Brexit, was it a little artificial just because of Brexit? You have Labour openly running. They're telling you, like, hey, we're trying to get, you talked about the red wall up north. They're like, they're openly talking about, we want to get these voters back that we lost because of Brexit. You know, 2016 was 8 years ago. That 2019 election, that was a long time ago. Boris is off the scene now and left, let's call what it is, left a mess in his wake that the Conservatives are still kind of dealing with. So the personality part of it didn't really deal with. The majority of that seems to be a little bit of a false majority. That's a lot of the underlying to a lot of this, right? Is you've had this seismic event. Now the seismic event isn't seismic anymore because Brexit's basically a settled issue for all practical purposes, even though people still yell about it. Now they've got to settle back into.
Yes.
But, you know, what? Well, Ireland's always going to be a mess. Scotland's always going to scream about independence. Those are kind of new switches on something you've already been doing. Is that a fair way to say it? These parties have got to kind of figure out what they're going to be post-Brexit, because they just talked about Brexit nonstop for 5 years. And now it's like, okay, that's over with. People want to hear about something else. What are we? So to go back to that long-winded answer is, you can't project this list of things you're going to be if you don't know what you are yourself. Do these parties really know what they are themselves right now?
No, none of them do. And it might sound strange to say, but the 2019 general election was the landslide victory that the Conservative Party may never recover from. That sounds a very weird thing to say. But what they did is inflate their party to a size of a coalition with different parts that cannot be in the same political party together. So the 2019 Conservative Party... Yeah, and bear in mind, not only did they win a staggering number of seats, they only lost one seat, which was Putney in central London. They narrowly lost that to the Labour Party. They retained all of their seats that they won in 2017 when they came close to winning a majority, and also gained a staggering number, mostly in the West Midlands and the North, in those traditional Labour heartlands. And so what you had was a group of MPs who were a mixture of the new intake from these traditional Labour heartlands that were kind of very pro-economic redistribution. You had the continuity coalition from David Cameron's era, which is much more southern geographically, and also that kind of compassionate, conservative, moderate, socially liberal, but also not too keen to kind of turn on the spending taps. And then you also had those smaller coalitions that have always existed in the Conservative Party, which are like the old style social conservatives, like really old style, you know, reasonably Christian, you know, Anglican traditionalists, skeptical of even things like gay marriage, which is a completely settled issue in the UK, and then smaller groups, you know, ones that would be closer to my views, the classical liberals, the libertarians, who are more focused on kind of supply side free market reforms, you know, cutting red tape, particularly on things like housing and energy, and those groups of people, they just can't live together. It's not possible. You can't have a consensus politics that brings all of those groups of people in. Can't be done. Their views are mutually exclusive. And so the Conservative Party just didn't know how to do it. Boris Johnson could get away with it to some extent, because Boris Johnson confirms my view that politics is mostly about vibes. It's about the vibe of a high profile candidate. So that's how Donald Trump, a man who goes to the bathroom in a golden toilet, becomes the champion of the downtrodden working class West Virginian or Pennsylvanian. That's how Boris Johnson, the elite public school educated posh boy, becomes the first conservative to win, you know, northern working class, hard man, coal mining seats like Blythe Valley. That's how John Fetterman, for example, you know, senator from Pennsylvania, a progressive candidate, has one of the best Democratic performances with those working class people in western, southwestern Pennsylvania for a decade or so. Really, they're big guys with big personalities who have clear enemies, and they don't like the nonsense from those enemies. And but really, while you can win an election or two based on the big guy who's got the good vibes, you can't then go on to build a sustainable electoral coalition around that when those important men are gone. This will be a problem that will haunt the Republican Party, because, I mean, look, you know, the, as I said before, the elites of the Republican Party have totally capitulated to Donald Trump. I have no optimism that the Republican Party will rid itself of Donald Trump. But at some point, the man's going to die, right? So at the point where Donald Trump leaves, is no longer the figurehead of the Republican Party, they're going to have exactly the same problem as the Conservative Party do, because they have got a coalition that's unsustainable. The West Virginia ex-coal miner and the sort of suburban Washington, D.C. tax cutter, they're not going to work well together in a coalition. It's just not going to happen. Now, that problem's down the line because Trump is still alive and kicking and doing his thing. But it is exactly that, as you said. You can't, because you won a landslide, and so you should be able to just go, great, we can do whatever we want, basically. But they haven't been able to figure out what it means. They haven't been able to reconcile the traditional identity of the party with their new voters. That's why we are where we are. And by the way, this could be a problem for Keir Starmer as well, because he is looking at potentially a bigger win than Boris Johnson in 2019, especially if Nigel Farage re-enters politics with the Reform Party and further dents the Conservatives. Conservatives could be looking at a serious wipeout here. Starmer's going to have the same problem, because he is going to have that mixture of progressive voters in central London and those more, at least culturally, traditionalist voters up in the north in the seats that he wins back, that the Conservatives won in 2019. In 5 years, we could be talking about exactly the same problem. Does the Labour Party know what it is? And then it's also got an activist base that's very much more economically and socially left-wing than most of the country is. That's going to have an influence as well. I don't see this problem ending. The parties need to figure it out.
Harrison Griffiths joining us. You touched on it there, but let's just go there. You earlier mentioned George Galloway and some radicalism that's forming on the left in the UK. We already know what's going on in the right in the UK. Just like in America, there's a lot of foreign influence, and there's also just some natural ugly stuff that bubbles up culturally on the right, on the extremes of the right. When the middle's not steady, those things tend to grow, and they tend to get room to operate. I'm starting to hear, and look, we're having the same problem in America, so I'm not throwing a rock here. I think it's a universe, like you just talked about with some of this electoral stuff. Some of this is universal human stuff, right? It's just human nature stuff. Is there a concern that some of this uncertainty, when you have malaise and you have a lot of unhappy people and you don't have a lot of political recourse and you don't have people seeing things getting better, that's when you start getting radicalism, both on the left and the right? How big a concern is that, especially if you're going to have a change in government that says we're here for big change, and just kind of institutionally, they're not really going to be able to have big sweeping change. All due respect to Keir Starmer and Labour and whatever you think about Labour, just institutionally, they're not going to get big sweeping change when they get into power. So this is going to kind of continue for a while. The concern for more radicalism, as long as this keeps going the way it's going, has got to be there in the UK like it is in America. Yes.
Yes. So yeah, Keir Starmer is not a big sweeping institutional change guy. And the reason is he doesn't really need to be. So the institutions of government, despite 14 years now of Conservative Party leadership, are still very much Tony Blair's creation. All of Tony Blair's sweeping constitutional reforms, creating more unelected, we call them quangos, but you might call them, you know, regulatory agencies, more kind of a slight democratic reforms to the way Parliament works. All of that stuff is like totally untouched by the Conservatives in the last 14 years. So Keir Starmer is going to inherit an institutional setup in government that's already geared towards him. So he will probably just build on some of that stuff. There'll be, you know, he'll build on legislation like the now increasingly controversial Equality Act 2010. He will, you know, make that more kind of diversity quota oriented, probably. It won't be any massive sweeping change. And there's also an element that kind of fears that in the Labour Party, because in 1983, when they had a far left leader, they got battered by Mrs. Thatcher. In 2019, when they had a far left leader, they got battered by Boris Johnson. There is a fear of going too radical in the Labour Party, so they'll probably stay slightly on the safe side. What the Conservative Party will do in opposition, I mean, we don't even know if they're going to be a serious opposition force at the moment. Again, you know, we should not understate the chance they could be really wiped out here. But what they do will be interesting to watch, because they've got lots of potential paths they can go down. I couldn't forecast it. I really don't know what the Conservative Party is going to do after they lose. But, you know, you talk about the emergence of radical politics on the left. I think a landslide Keir Starmer win will be a potential avenue for that to further itself. Because, as I said, the Labour Party's got an activist base. And I mean that as members of the Labour Party, but also people in groups that are close to the Labour Party, like the trade unions, for example, who will want to push for much more radical change, particularly economically. And when you have a landslide, it also kind of reduces the danger of the left part of the Labour parliamentary party to rebel against Keir Starmer, to try and force him to do more radical stuff. Because if you rebel against him and you've got a massive landslide, you're not going to bring down the government or anything. You can just kind of leverage them. If you've got a smaller majority, then you don't want to rock the boat too much, because you know it might bring the government down. And then you've also got this backdrop of radical progressives, you know, students across the country who are left-oriented, people in the London kind of political class, and also Muslim voters in London and also in cities and towns in the north, who are getting very, very upset over Gaza. And I think it's likely that this will still be a live issue in a year's time, where Keir Starmer will definitely be the Prime Minister. And he'll actually have to be making decisions about this as the person who sets foreign policy for his government. So that's going to be a problem for him as well. And you mentioned, you know, the increasing radicalism on the left and right coming from people kind of being disaffected with politics and not getting what they want. I think there are two sides to it. There is the traditional analysis, very much an analysis embraced by Karl Marx, which I generally subscribe to, that people get angry and people get radicalized when things economically, culturally get bad. I think there's a lot of truth to that. But there's also the analysis that was provided all the way back in the day by Alexis de Tocqueville, who said that people start to get radicalized when things are good. So when things are good, people get bored, and people's expectations of things getting better are much higher, and people's understanding of why things are so much better than they used to be is kind of nil. They don't really understand why that happened. They just take it for granted. So surely things can only get better if we just make decisions, if we just guide society in a general direction that makes them feel better. There's both of those forces, I think, are being exerted on politics in Britain and America. Like, Britain and America are two of the richest countries in human history, right? America is literally the richest country in human history, the greatest country in human history, I would argue. And, you know, Britain's much poorer than America, but we're still pretty rich. And yeah, we're seeing that increasing radicalization. There are an awful lot of different forces pulling on this, but the trajectory doesn't look good. And as I say, we're going to have a change of government. We're going to have a change of party leading the government for the first time in 14 years. But I don't think it's going to change much, because I think Starmer's going to have a lot of the same problems as Boris Johnson did after 2019, keeping this new coalition together. And really, I think he may have even greater problems, because there is that radical activist base in the Labour Party and in its close affiliates, which can tap into something with important Labour Party voters. I think it's going to be difficult for him.
Yeah, Harrison Griffin. On a lighter note, though, I got to admit, though, I don't like the comparisons of Trump and Boris Johnson, even though they both have bad haircuts and they're both loud. I've never heard Donald Trump rattle off Homer in the original Greek at length. So yes. I know at least Boris paid attention at school. I'm pretty sure Trump did not. So they do have some differences, we should point out, just on a lighter note.
Yeah, I completely agree. People who tried to compare the two, I think it's a hopeless comparison. They are superficially similar insofar as they're two big characters who are quite populist and malleable in terms of what they think, and who led their parties in periods of great realignment and great political strife and conflict. Once you go beyond that those superficial similarities, you have very different people. Boris Johnson is significantly more intelligent than Donald Trump. And say of that what you want. I mean, it's a good thing insofar as, you know, having a more intelligent leader is a good thing. But it's arguably worse on Boris Johnson, because Boris Johnson knows it, but Boris Johnson's populist and bad decision making is much more calculated thing than Trump. Trump doesn't really have much of an ideological base. He's got some sentiments and vibes, but he doesn't really have much of a coherent worldview. When he's all over the place and changing his mind depending on the last person who's spoken to him, it kind of makes sense for his character. For Boris Johnson, it's a more calculated thing. And also just, you know, the way that they governed is very different. Like, Trump is a faux populist who is beholden in many ways to religious conservatism, which he clearly he doesn't believe. He's obviously not a committed Christian, I don't think. And he governed economically much more like a traditional Republican. His biggest accomplishment really was the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And also, you know, Trump, where he diverged from the traditional Republican governance was on things like tariffs. You know, he's a massive trade protectionist. Boris Johnson, not so much. Johnson was, you know, someone who on the economy was much more left wing, really. He was much more pro-redistribution, and he was very much an advocate of free trade, of this idea of global Britain after Brexit, a much more outward looking, free trading nation that looks beyond Europe and itself. Trump's much more of, we would call it over here, a little Englander, but a little Americaner, I guess you could say.
Yeah, Harrison Griffin. All right, we beat up on Keir Starmer pretty good, but to be fair, let's just assume probably going to go that way. He's going to be the next prime minister. Rishi Sunak is going to stay prime minister, because who's going to want that job at the end? And he, you know, he's going to be a good party man and go down with the ship and take it to the end, I think. That bench looks pretty weak. When Keir Starmer takes the premiership, it's probably going to be a while before the Conservative Party gets their next guy. So we can knock Keir Starmer for being next man up and for having, you know, the charisma of a beige hallway in a government building, and all that may be true. However, he was the obvious clear choice, and politically there's a lot of value in having the obvious next person ready for leadership, ready to go. And that's going to benefit the Labour Party very good. The Tories and the Conservative Party don't have that, and it may take them quite a while to organize that. Is that a fair way to lay out and something to watch for?
Yeah, definitely. And I just want to be clear in defense of Keir Starmer a little bit. As I said, on policy stuff, we have tremendous disagreements, but I think Keir Starmer is clearly a good man. I think he's a man of integrity. He's clearly a very learned man. I think he's got some intellectual depth to him. I think he's thoughtful. And I think, you know, in terms of, as we talked about before with the nukes, I think in terms of the base operations of being prime minister, he will do a very good job. Like, nothing kind of worries me about Keir Starmer that doesn't really worry me about Rishi Sunak. So he's a good guy at the very least, I think. And but with Sunak, you know, you've got someone who is basically a lame duck at this point. Nobody wants to take the mantle from him because, you know, who wants to be the guy who comes in for 6 months and gets battered? You're going to discredit yourself and your own political career, and also probably discredit the faction of the party from which you emerge. There isn't an obvious success for the Conservative Party. And, you know, if the Conservative Party is still intact as a serious political force after the next election, there will be the mother of leadership battles. You have lots of different wings for the party which will put forward candidates expressing very different visions for what the party and what the country should be going forward. So you've got people who are in Sunak's cabinet, like Penny Mordaunt, who's the leader of the House of Commons, who will probably be a bit of a continuity Cameron type of candidate, I think. Kemi Badenoch, who is the business and trade secretary, who will put forward, I think, something close to Thatcherism, probably a Thatcherism for the post-Brexit age, I think Badenoch will do. There'll probably be a token candidate put forward by the serious free market side of the Conservative Party, you know, someone like Simon Clark, maybe. There'll be the populist National Conservative candidate. That might be Suella Braverman, who was the Home Secretary twice. There will be a serious contest if the Conservative Party is still a significant electoral force. And that will be interesting because it will be a real battle of ideas. And we haven't really had a proper battle of ideas. We haven't seen one from the Conservative Party in terms of its leadership election for a long while. Boris Johnson was nailed on winner. Theresa May was coronated. The last time we saw it was probably 2006, when David Cameron, 2005, I think, actually, sorry, when David Cameron beat David Davis in the leadership election. So that's going to be a serious battle of ideas, and it may well be a productive one. But if I were a betting man, and I'm not really, and it's perhaps a bit foolish to bet on modern politics in the UK and the US at least, I would say that the person who wins the Conservative Party leadership after the election will not be the person to lead them into the general election, because I think you're likely to still have an awful lot of tension. And first term governments very rarely get voted out in the UK. Voters usually give them a second shot. And if Keir Starmer, you know, runs the country reasonably competently, I suspect he'll get re-elected, and that will be difficult for the Conservative Party to deal with. But again, all of that at this point really is conjecture. I think the overarching message of politics in Britain over the last decade and a half is expect the unexpected.
Yeah, and we shouldn't really talk because we in America are about to elect either Joe Biden or Donald Trump president. So we're definitely projecting so that we don't have to deal with our own problems, my friend. I'm not just picking on the UK. I will tell you this. One of my German friends was laughing. He said Keir Starmer's first act should be a bilateral move. Meeting with Germany with a big press conference, because next to Olaf Scholz, who is nicknamed the machine in German, and it's not a compliment, folks, it's because of how he's dull and boring. He's like, it'll make Keir Starmer seem very exciting to everybody. That should be his first move. That came from one of our German friends. So there is hope, my friend.
Yeah, so I'd be interested to see whether Olaf Scholz is Chancellor of Germany for much longer. It may be a good idea to have a press conference with whoever's the president of the United States come early next year. It'll make Starmer look very virile and young in comparison.
Yeah, and that, you know, my daughter actually brought this up because I was telling her, I was like, well, I'm going to do a UK thing. And we were riding in the car and listening. And it's become a tradition over the years, you know, prime minister questions, because of the time difference, comes on right as I'm taking my kids to school traditionally. So they grew up kind of listening to prime minister questions and getting, of course, I'm talking about the real fun ones when Theresa May was just firing at everybody and trying to hold on for dear life, you know, those sorts of things. And she made the comment this morning. I thought it was really funny. She's like, you know, when they're done with their leaders, they just leave. And it took me a second and I had to think about it. And I was like, yeah, that's right. Because we have terms and our presidents serve their full terms out with very rare exceptions, you know, other than, you know, Nixon. And we tried to impeach Trump and that didn't work out. But, you know, it's a very different thing when your leaders are politically done. They pretty much have to shuffle off stage, right? And ours is, we kind of suffer through for a couple of years for the end of their term. It is a very different thing.
Well, yes, that has been true of British politics for most of the last 50 years, but it's actually really changing now. So Theresa May was noticeable, was notable when she left. I mean, she never tried to exert pressure on the direction of the party after she left, but she stayed on as an MP, which, and as a very active MP. Like, again, Theresa May is somebody with whom I would have profound philosophical and policy disagreements. But to her credit, she is clearly a dedicated servant to her constituency and to her country. And she's going to step down at the next election, but she, you know, stayed on for another election and served a full term as MP for Maidenhead. That's quite rare. Liz Truss obviously got batted out after 49 days. She is still very keen to influence the trajectory of the party. Where she gets her confidence, I really don't know. But she is very much
America.
Still...
She is all over the place over here on the right wing and in Republican circles and Republicans.
Yes.
She has been all over the place this winter and spring. Every major conference, Liz Truss has been at it. She's in America all the time right now. It's crazy.
Yeah, she is. And she has radically, in my opinion, misunderstood the philosophical trajectory of politics that politics will take on both sides of the Atlantic over the next 20 years. She is, I think, clearly trying to revive fusionism, which was, you know, the dominant political strategy on the right in the US and to some extent in the UK between, you know, between the mid 1970s and the mid 2010s, which was the free market, broadly speaking, economic policies and the social conservatism. You know, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher are kind of the epitome of fusionism. Fusionism's dead. It's not going to come back. And, you know, she's also a political chameleon in that sense. I think she spent her entire life being a fairly kind of classical liberal free market type person. She clearly still believes in free markets. But when she goes around talking to CPAC, for example, you know, the average attendant of CPAC agrees a lot more with Viktor Orban than they do with Ronald Reagan. That's very clear. And she still seems to think that the Reagan-Thatcherite coalition is dominant on the American right and that it's savable in other countries. She's totally wrong about that. But she is still trying to push the party in a certain direction, whatever. Boris Johnson stayed on as an MP. He was there in the background. There were reports he was going to run to take back his old position when Liz Truss imploded. He did then resign amid a cloud of controversy, but he is still very much in the background. He still has a loyal following of people. And again, this is why politics is, you know, I think politics is about vibes, because you see elements of the Conservative Party from all different sides, from the moderate side, from the populist side, from the free market side, who say, bring back Boris. Yeah, Boris wasn't a friend to any of their groups, really, in terms of what he actually did. But because he is who he is, there is an appetite for him. So he's still around. So we are kind of still haunted by our recently ejected leaders, at the very least, for the first time in quite a long time. David Cameron's even back now as Foreign Secretary. I mean, he's not going to be a serious political force, but he's back. So we're still haunted by it, just as you're increasingly haunted by it. Ex-American presidents have always had more of an influence, really, than ex-British prime ministers. But, you know, even now, we're seeing, obviously, a massive increase in that. You know, Donald Trump's trying to do a Grover Cleveland. Barack Obama and Bill Clinton are very much kind of staple parts of Joe Biden's campaign going forward. Bill Clinton, obviously, was in some ways going for a third term and maybe a fourth term with the run of Hillary Clinton. Those two very much, of course, a political team. And so, yeah, the influence of the ex-leaders is growing in both countries. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I'll leave that to everybody to decide. But it's certainly an interesting development.
Yep. And as we are speaking, John Sweeney, who's back in charge of the S&P after 20 years.
Yes.
So, you know, there's that. Oh, almost 25 years. He was elected first in 2002. Although, to be fair, he said he's going to be a caretaker, do one full term and so on. But we'll talk about Scotland some other time. Harrison Griffin got a little long, but it was all really, really good stuff. I love the parallels because there's differences, but people are still people and human nature is still human nature. And there's some universal principles and those sort of things, especially between two really close allies in a very tumultuous world in the UK and America, our friends across the sea. And we like all kings after George III. So other than him, you know, we all get along good. Let folks know how they can keep up with you and follow along. Great having you back on. Appreciate the insight. Let folks know how they can keep up with you until we get you back on Hurtel again, my friend.
Absolutely. So I go on Twitter by @RealHarrisonG, and my day job is working in communications at the Institute of Economic Affairs, a free market think tank in London. I tend we tend and I tend not to do much talking about the to's and fro's of electoral politics. I have done today. So if you're looking for that stuff, that's not usually my cup of tea, but you can follow along with the IEA on all social media platforms. And if you go and visit our website, mostly economic stuff. So if you're interested in that, please do give us a follow and keep up with our stuff.
That's what makes you perfect to talk about it, because you know what you're talking about, but you're also not ate up with it. So you've got good perspective, my friend. Appreciate your time, Harrison Griffin. Always enjoy it. Enjoy your evening, sir.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you, sir.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Herd Tell. That'll do it for this particular program. We so appreciate you giving us the most precious thing you have, your time. Couple things we'd like to ask you to do, if you don't mind. However you're listening to this program, whether it's on a podcast platform, iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, any podcast platform out there, we are on it. Herd Tell Show, Herd Tell, my name, Andrew Donaldson, should bring it right up for you. Please make sure you subscribe. If that platform gives you the option to leave a rating or a comment, please do that. It doesn't cost you anything but a couple clicks and a few minutes of your time. It means a lot to us because of a couple of reasons. One is we just really appreciate hearing from you and let you know you're out there. Two is that also lets those platforms know that people are listening to the program and interacting with it, and lets them know that our program is worth their time and their attention as well. Also, one-stop shopping for everything we do Herdtell-wise, herdtell.substack.com. Subscribe for free, and everything we do, whether it's a Herdtell episode, whether it's my writing, whether it's a media appearance, we do News, Notes, and Notions every Sunday now. We have some other things working that we're going to do. Also, we re-archive some stuff. We pull stuff out of the vault and put it on there from time to time. Everything from the Yonder and Home food writing to past episodes of Herd Tell. All of that, one-stop shopping, herdtell.substack.com. Subscription is free. If you want to donate money, we'll take it. We're not going to turn you down, but all the content is free. Puts it right into your inbox to whatever email you prefer, and you will never miss a thing that goes on with Herd Tell. It's a great way for us to keep up with you. Also gives you the ability to leave comments and to interact with us and let us know what you think about the program. We'd love to hear from you. Herd Tell Show at gmail.com. Herd Tell Show on the Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. Follow us, subscribe. We'd really appreciate it. And that'll do it for this edition. Wherever you are and whoever you're with, we hope you're well. We hope you're well fed. And we can't wait to talk to you again on the next edition of Herd Tell. All the music on Herd Tell is provided under a Creative Content License from MonsterCat.com. Somos la máquina.